Good morning and welcome to Words That Matter, a modern day book club. And I'm your host, Lee Smith. I'm stumbling over words because I'm so excited about today's show. I'm so excited about the guest. I'm sure you've all seen him in all sorts of movies. He's perhaps most famously known for his role on Justified, a fantastic TV show. He's written a new book. And the book is called Justify This, A Career Without Compromise. Welcome, Mr. Nick Searcy. Thank you so much for being here with us today on Words That Matter.
Lee, thanks for having me. It's great to talk to somebody who's actually read the book.
Oh yeah, I love the book. I mean, you know, even if you weren't coming on, I'm going to have to buy the book so I feel honest and I can give it to friends because I got to read it for free. So, but I would pay hundreds to read this book, to read your account. And I got to say, I mean, not only do I really love the book, I'm reading it and I'm smiling the whole time just because it seems like you've had such a wonderful career and such a wonderful life.
I've been very fortunate, I must say. I mean, you know, when I moved to New York after college and started trying to be an actor, it was not always so easy those early years, but it really turned out well. And I think that, like I say in the book, I think I was pretty much led through all that. I was protected, and God was looking out for me, and everything turned out to be pretty good.
Well, I mean, first of all, you're talking about living in New York. I was raised in New York, so I know a lot of those areas, and I know a lot of people, you know, actors, none of them who had as had a spectacular career as you had, but I know what that life is like. And so for you to, you know, for you to have gone through all that and, you know, again, all your amazing achievements. But you're talking about how you feel that God led you through it. God was watching. So there's that one incredible scene where you're looking to cast someone for the movie Gosnell, which you directed. I want to talk about all your acting as soon as possible, but I want to talk about this because it was so moving. You walk in and there's a young woman and she's the manager of a restaurant and you're just impressed with her and you haven't been able to cast this particular role yet. And you talk to her and then you find out something kind of miraculous. So if you could explain that.
Yeah, we were doing the movie Gosnell, which is about, of course, Kermit Gosnell, the abortion doctor who was convicted of murder for killing live babies in Philadelphia. And there was this one role of a woman who went into Gosnell's clinic and changed her mind after talking to him. And he said he could not reverse the procedure. And she went somewhere else and she had her baby. And I just couldn't find the right person anyway. I'm in this Waffle House on a Sunday morning. It's really busy. The supervisor there, young lady, she's kind of talking to all the customers. And I kept sort of getting a feeling about her. I kept sort of saying that she looks exactly right for the part. I wonder if she can act. So I did the whole, you know, I know this sounds like a line, but I really am a Hollywood producer. I really am making a movie. And have you ever acted before? Anyway, long story short, she said, "No, I've never acted before, but I talked to her about it. There was only a couple of lines. She came in and did the part. And then only after she had come in and done the part, and she did really well, did I find out that that exact situation had happened to her in real life. She had gone in to have an abortion, changed her mind, and went ahead and had the baby. And it was just such one of those moments where it was like, okay, that's got to be God leading me to the right person. It can't be anything else."
No, it's really a moving scene. Look, there's another scene too that I want to ask you about in your book, which isn't really about acting. It's not about acting at all. It's when you and your wife decide that you want another child and you adopt a boy, you adopt a boy named Omar, and you walk in. A lot of people know you as an actor. You know, you play some of the roles as you describe. You play not nice guys, but also, you know, as deputy, deputy marshal in Justified. So you're a tough guy. You walk into a prison and you see this young, you know, the child you're adopting, his biological father, and this young man's in prison. And you keep pointing out how this is a very young man. and the conversation you have with him that you describe in the book. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because again, this is just a really stirring and amazing scene.
Well, thank you, Lee. I mean, that the adoption of our son Omar was quite a learning experience for us, and one of the best things that we've ever done. I mean, Omar's doing great. He's 24 years old. He's in film school. He's doing great. But yes, when we adopted him, he came out of the foster care system, but as you know, the foster care system takes a very long time to terminate parental rights. Sometimes it never happens. And so he had been with us for almost 3.5 years. And I was beginning to think that it was never going to be terminated. So I went to the parents, both the mother after a hearing and the father. Well, the mother first. And I said, you know, if you let us adopt your son, we will stay in touch with you. If the state ever terminates your rights, they won't even let you know where he is. But I promise to stay in touch with you. She agreed. And then I had to go talk to his biological father, who at the time was in jail, and talk to him through the glass and just explain to him. I knew he had some fears and some objections, and I knew he felt helpless because he was, had his son taken away from him by the state. And so when I talked to him, I said, you know, his name was Omar too. I said, Omar, I know you're concerned about your son being raised by white people. I can't do anything about that, but I'll tell you this. I love your son. I will make sure he knows his history, and I will do the best I can. I'll make sure he does his homework. I will take care of him for you. And I said, I know that I give you my word as a man. And Omar Sr. said, tell the social worker to come talk to me tomorrow. And he decided to sign over his rights. And we have stayed in touch with both his birth mother and his father, his siblings, everybody. Omar knows exactly where he's from. He knows his whole birth family. He knows his story, because we didn't want him to have any, questions about anything. And it's worked out well for all of us. Omar Sr. is still a pen pal of mine. He's still in prison, but I think he gets out in a couple of years.
And now your son, as you talk about in the book, I mean, you worked on two movies about January 6th. And I want to get to those in some detail in a bit, but your son worked on those movies with you. So he's also joined the film industry.
Yeah. Yeah. He's done some acting. He's done a little bit of everything. And, I think I kid him. I say, you want to be in the film business because you've watched me as an actor work about 40 or 50 days a year for 20, 30 years and go, hey, that was a pretty good year. I worked like 40 days.
well, you say when you're talking about Justified, that doing a TV series is about the best job you can get. Well, first of all, it's not only a lot of fun, and that's why you got into acting to begin with, but because of the hours. So can you talk about I'm sure everyone wants to talk to you about Justified all the time. So, yeah. I definitely do.
Well, the hours for everybody on a TV show are not great. I mean, and there are those days where you have to get up at 5 a.m, but, and if I was Tim Oliphant, I would be getting up every day at 5 a.m. But for a character actor like me, I would work 1 or 2 days a week. They'd come in. I'd be in my office. I'd tell Raylan, stop shooting people. And then I'd go home and I'd go play golf, So it was a great job for me. But for a character actor, that's a pretty cushy gig. You don't make as much money as the lead guy, but you don't have to be there as much either.
And it seems that you got along really well with everyone on the set, including Graham Yost, who's the showrunner, and he wrote one of the. You have yet. I should say that Nick Searcy has two introductions for his book here, one from the right and one from the left, and they're both pretty funny, especially the one from the left from Graham Yost. So you got along well with everyone on the set.
Yes, I've gotten along well with pretty much everybody. I kid them. I say I've been tolerating you stupid Democrats my whole career, So it's no big deal. I'm used to putting up with you guys. They have trouble putting up with us sometimes. But I've never really you know, had a big confrontation on a set or anything. I don't try to evangelize my politics when I'm working.
Well, one of the amazing things about reading the book is, you know, you're talking about Edward Albee, you're talking about working with these great actors, you're talking about all this impressive stuff. And I really hope it gets to people on the left as well, actually. I don't know the likelihood of that, but one of the important things, like, look, this is an accomplished actor. This is a real person, right? He's a serious actor. You may think he's just pushing conservative politics that you feel uncomfortable with, but he's talking about the important work he's done as an artist, as a creative person.
Well, the book is not primarily a political book. I mean, there's certainly a couple of chapters in there about, the making of the January 6th documentaries and the making of Gosnell. I mean, those are more approached from, you know, an artistic standpoint, how we made it, you know, how hard it was to make, that kind of thing. So the book itself is not political. I mean, I make a few little jokes in there, like, how I played a lot of really, really terrible people, serial killers and sexual harassers and wife beaters. And let's face it, I've played a lot of Democrats, but that's just a joke. I mean, yeah, I hope that people don't reject it because they think it's going to be too political, because it's really not that political.
Well, you mentioned that there were times like after January 6th, and I want to talk about the January 6th movies shortly. But you said that there was a moment when, or there have been times when you felt that people are holding your politics against you. I'll just say first, the most surprising thing about the book is that most people are not, at least in the earliest chapters. People are like, yeah, there's Nick Searcy. I know him from here. We worked together then. And, you know, you have an argument with Tommy Lee Jones, but it's about acting. It's not about politics. Right. So right. Were you surprised after January 6th, when there seems to have been a sea change?
Well, you know, I had felt it earlier than that. I mean, you know, the election of Trump in 2017 just sort of drove the left insane. And so anybody in Hollywood who was seen as like not claiming that they voted for Hillary Clinton, and much less being proud that you voted for President Trump. I mean, I was feeling it even then. I mean, I don't have any like information about specific projects that I was denied because of my politics or anything like that. But I do. Yeah, there was some slowing down for me after Trump was elected. But I've got enough. I mean, that's the thing. I've never really had to have another job. I've always made a living, and a pretty good one, being an actor. And it didn't change during the Trump years. I wrote a few op-eds. I made Gosnell during those years. But I also made a Stephen King miniseries, and I did Guillermo del Toro's Shape of Water. And, you know, I mean, I continued to work. And it was really January 6th, though, when January 6th happened, that's when things kind of got really like overtly, okay, something's going on here. And I tell a story in the book about that, about my agent calling me and giving me some information the Saturday after January 6th.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and I want to pick it up when we come back. I'd like you to tell that story about your agent and what happened. And also, I'd like to talk about your January 6th movies. And then I also have to ask you, who are the actors you liked working with most, and who are the ones who gave you the biggest problems? Again, I've got so much to ask you, and I know we're going to run out of time. But right now, we got to take a quick break. If you're watching on YouTube, please make the jump exclusively to Epoch TV. We're making the jump. So please come back with us, having a fantastic conversation with one of my favorite actors, now one of my favorite writers. You got to read his first book, great book, Nick Searcy, Justify This, A Career Without Compromise. See you in a sec.
You know, a 16-year-old girl who has undergone an attempted gender transition. She's gone on testosterone for years and got a double mastectomy, and then realizes that this was a mistake, that she can't actually become another gender. To go back to her doctor and tell the doctor this was all a mistake is kind of akin to going back to an abuser that has hurt you very much and saying, hey, you abused me and I didn't like it, and I'm just letting you know that I'm done with you abusing me. The doctors who are involved in this organization were aware that some of the testosterone hormones they're giving to girls were causing tumors. They were also aware that the young patients couldn't fully informed consent to these procedures since they were struggling from severe mental health issues. And they were aware that some patients were losing their fertility when they were taking testosterone. And yet none of them talked about this. And to the world, what they're saying is gender-affirming care is vital for the safety and well-being of young people. And denying this care to them is dangerous and is going to hurt them. And that's the messaging that we hear from the Biden White House, from the Department of Health and Human Services. That's the messaging we hear from the Department of Education, from all major medical organizations, which cite WPATH's expertise, even though WPATH is internally acknowledging that these types of things are experimental.
What happened to the medical profession? What happened to the media? What happened to the Biden White House? Please make sure and come back with us. Make the jump exclusively to Epoch TV. Hey, welcome back, and thanks for making the jump. We're here at Words That Matter, a modern-day book club, and I'm your host, Lee Smith, and we're speaking with Nick Searcy about his first book, Justify This, A Career Without Compromise. And before we went to the break, we were talking about what happened in Hollywood, what happened with Nick's career with January 6th. And he tells a story in his book about getting a phone call from his agent shortly after the 6th. So, Nick, if you can pick it up there.
Well, I had gone to Washington on January 6th, not with the idea of making a film, but just to sort of to participate in what I thought was a demonstration that wanted to verify the vote, make sure that Joe Biden actually won. And I didn't see any violence there that day. I walked around. I saw people singing and praying for the country. And when I got home that night, of course, I saw all the stuff on television, none of which I'd seen myself. And so that sort of gave me some pause. Why are they only showing that? Why didn't they show the rest of the day? That was totally peaceful and nice. But anyway, that Saturday night after January 6th, I was visiting my parents and I get a call from my agent on a Saturday night, which never happens. And I'm like, what's up? And he goes, I just got to ask you a question. Did you go in the building? I said, no. Why? He said, well, there's a casting director out here that's showing everybody a picture of you or somebody that she claims is you inside the building. And I asked him to show me the picture. And I said, that's obviously not me. That guy's wearing a mask. You know, I don't wear masks. and he's way heavier than I am. Anyway, I said, well, who's the casting director that's doing this? And when he told me, it was like, it was an old friend of mine. It was like somebody I'd known for 30 years who cast me in some of my best roles. And I was like, I wrote, she had my email. She had my phone number. I was like, I wrote her an email and said, why did you do this? Do you know that's not me? And she said, oh, I just wanted to make sure I would never do anything to hurt your career. And I said, well, you kind of did. So, you know, but that's kind of, after that, I sort of, okay, there is a whisper campaign. There are people out there who want to say, those people that support Trump, we're not going to hire any of them, you know. But like I said, for whatever reason, I've continued to get enough work to get by. I did 3 movies during the Trump years, and I've done a lot more since Biden was elected. So I'm, for whatever reason, I seem to be, at least have enough immunity from that kind of thing in Hollywood to keep going.
Well, because you're a great actor, and some of the different people that you've acted with. So I want to ask you now. Well, first of all, there's a lot of funny stuff in the book. There's first of all, the great Cicely Tyson hits you in the head with a rubber frying pan.
Yeah,
and that's a fun scene.
Rather harshly, she punished me rather harshly. She was kind of a method actress, I think.
Well, and then you wind up, and this certainly isn't Hollywood, but it's acting. When you're in the ring with professional wrestlers, and someone is jumping off the turnbuckle. I can't remember the name of the wrestler right now, but you wind up with a few cracked ribs. So that's.
Well, I think they were cracked. I never went to the doctor because I couldn't admit it to my wife that I'd actually gotten hurt, because she was telling me, if you better not do that, you're going to get hurt. And I'm like, no, I've watched wrestling for years. I know what I'm doing. But that was a real bucket list item to get to be in. I'm a big wrestling fan, always have been. And Matt Hardy's become a friend of mine. And that's kind of how that all came about.
Well, so who were the so Cecily Tyson, I mean, she's a great actress and she was probably great to work with, but in spite of the fact, or perhaps because of the fact, that she hit you in the head with a rubber frying pan.
The funny thing about Cecily was, when I met her in the makeup trailer, I was really honored. Fried Green Tomatoes was my first big role, and I was really like, wow, this is great, I finally made it. And Cecily Tyson, of course, was a hero of mine growing up, and so when I saw her in the makeup trailer, I stood up and said, "Miss Tyson, it's a pleasure to meet you." And she said, "I'm not shaking your hand." And she walked away. And I was like stunned. And like the makeup person goes, "She's a method actress. She hates you. It's nothing personal, you know." So, but then she did. Yeah, she had a big rubber frying pan. She kills me in the movie. So she almost killed me with that rubber frying pan too. She hit me pretty hard.
Is that what happened with Tommy Lee Jones too? Because you had a bit of a run in on in The Fugitive, another great movie you were in. What happened with Tommy Lee Jones?
Well, I won't tell the whole story, but in a nutshell, basically, when we did the read through, Tommy Lee, he told me he didn't like the way I was playing the part, and he thought I should play it some other way. And I kind of came back and said, no, I don't see the part that way. And he really kind of didn't like me very much after that, because I stood up for my interpretation of the role, and he thought I should have taken his. And you know, maybe he was right. He went on to win an Oscar, and you know, I didn't. But you know,
but there's something you say which makes total sense, which is, you know, you through all your training, you learn that it's not the job of another actor to tell another actor how to do their role. That's if the director steps in and says, look, here's what we want, here's what we need, but it's another actor shouldn't be doing that, no matter how big a star they are. So your explanation totally makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's sometimes the film business, that sort of gets the balance of power gets outweighed by stardom. And so I think that was the problem. I was waiting for the director to weigh in and say, you know, say something, but he was like, all he would do is look, cause since Tommy Lee's so huge, he would just go, well, it's an interesting idea, Nick. So it was sort of, okay. And I had to make a decision, and I decided to stand up for myself. So
that's great. Well, so who are the actors that you like best working with?
Well, the one that was really just a dream come true for me was when I did Runaway Jury with Gene Hackman, because Gene Hackman was really the one person when I was growing up who I just thought I can be like that guy. He's not that good looking either. I can be an actor. So it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience working with Gene. A dream come true. I've enjoyed so much of my career. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I enjoyed working with Tim Oliphant a lot on Justified. Great actor, just a really good sense of humor, a really dedicated artist. I really enjoyed my time with him. And I really enjoyed my time with Tom Hanks. I mean, worked with him in two different projects, one where he produced From the Earth to the Moon, and one where I was able to act with him in Castaway. I've had tremendous luck and worked with really great people. I think people that make really bad movies don't think I'm very good. So I don't get a lot of bad movies.
look, to come back to Gene Hackman for a second, what are your favorite Gene Hackman movies? Cause I don't want to trap you, but some of those movies from the '70s and stuff.
Oh yeah.
It's really interesting because they sort of describe the time that we're in now. right?
Yes,
the conversation.
They do.
The conversation is one that in particular sticks out in my mind. But I want to know what your favorite Gene Hackman movies are without me bloviating here.
Well, I love The Conversation. I love Bonnie and Clyde, of course, which was his first film and the film when I first saw him. And there's a really kind of interesting film that not a lot of people have seen called Twice in a Lifetime that I've been looking for. Twice in a Lifetime, Gene Hackman and Anne Margaret. And it's about a divorced man who falls in love again. And I don't know. When I saw that movie, I marveled at his performance, you know, because he took a character that on the surface should have been despicable. And he made you really understand him and really forgive him by the end and love him. And I recommend that movie highly. It's kind of a forgotten film, but it's called Twice in a Lifetime.
Oh, that sounds great. Let me ask about your two January 6th movies. So I imagine these are hard movies to make. You talk about some people in the book. You talk about Jerry Perna. And I've spoken with, that's the story of her wonderful, her beautiful nephew, Matthew. It's just a terrible story.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine those movies were very hard for you to make.
I basically, you know, the second movie, The War on Truth, which we released last Friday, it's at salemnow.com. If anybody wants to go and watch it, but I really, all the interviews, I think, I said, we're going to have to edit out all these parts where I'm crying because I'm just weeping through the whole movie. I mean, what has been done to these people in the name of political power? These are decent, wonderful people who are being totally persecuted, totally misused. Some of them have committed suicide, like Matthew Perna. A lot of them have had their lives completely destroyed. They've been demonized in the press. Joe Biden calling them racist, white supremacists, and terrorists. They're pariahs in their neighborhood. They've lost their businesses. They've lost their families. A lot of them are middle-class people who don't have the money to mount a vigorous defense against this kind of this kind of government power. And it is really a moving, heart-wrenching film. That's the reason I wanted to make The War on Truth. The second movie is because I wanted to tell these stories. I wanted to humanize these people and show America who these people are that the government is trying to destroy. And it's not right. It should not be happening in the United States.
First of all, what kind of impact are the movies making now against the mainstream narrative? And then I want to ask, how do you think people will look at these movies in 25, 50 years, will it be like, I can't believe this happened in America? Or will people say, yeah, it's kind of a question about which way our country's heading now.
It depends on who takes power. I mean, that's the thing. Whoever writes the history books gets to tell their version of the truth. And that's why we call the movie The War on Truth. They are trying so desperately to suppress the truth of what happened. And that goes to censoring the release of the film. I mean, you know, it's hard to find the film with a simple Google search. You really have to know where to go. And that is part of what they do. They don't want the truth to come out. They want you to only hear their version of what happened on January 6th and their characterization of who the people were that went there that day. And so that is the war on truth. They're trying to keep this movie from being seen. And the only way to combat that is for people like your audience to go out there and get hold of this movie, because you're going to see things in this movie, both about these people and about the people behind what happened on January 6th, that you're not going to see anywhere else. You're not going to see it on the mainstream media. You're not even going to see it on Fox News. This is one place where you can find this material.
Well, you're right. I want to encourage viewers to go out and see The War on Truth. I mean, this is an audience that knows an awful lot about what happened on January 6th. I mean, the true story. Epoch TV, our reporters have done a great job about pushing through, telling the real story that this was not an insurrection, what really happened, what really went down. But Nick, they've got to see your movie too, The War on Truth. And I must insist that viewers get a copy of Nick's book, his first book, Justify This, A Career Without Compromise. Nick Searcy, it has been such a, it's been such a thrill to get to talk to you. I wish it could go on and on forever, because again, I have so many questions to ask you about Hollywood and all the great stuff you've done. Congratulations. What a beautiful life, really. What a beautiful life, and what a wonderful, amazing career. God bless you, Nick. Thanks so much for being here today. And thanks to all of you for watching Words That Matter, a Modern Day Book Club. See you in the next episode. Help
yourself. I'm not really sure how long this whole exercise is supposed to last.
A lot of you have read his books. You may even have watched a movie.
No, I don't even think of him that way. He's old.
Lately, he has become the co-editor of a brand new magazine called County Highway.
We had a 10,000-word piece about traveling to see a Taylor Swift concert. You know, we have stories about everything from the wheat harvest in Kansas to, you know, an animal attack in Iowa to, the barroom storytelling in the current issue of a bunch of old cowboys in Elko, Nevada.
This is a magazine about America in the form of a 19th century newspaper.
It exists only as a newspaper, and it's the only one in the sense that we treat the country as a giant small town. We are one big family.